Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, continuing with our in-depth, ongoing investigative reporting series, AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV. Today is part 7. Now, I realize not everyone can listen to every single program, so where appropriate, I'll do some recapitulation, keeping in mind that I'm going to be quoting facts that are all from peer-reviewed journals. So where the problem in this whole discussion of AIDS has been is that we have accepted without question virtually all the information the mainstream media has disseminated. And the mainstream media has offered for dissemination without challenge virtually all the opinions, dogma, facts, and critical and non-critical judgment passed on by special interest groups. What we do not ask is, what if the original information that HIV was actually isolated, that it was actually proven to be the primary exclusive cause or exclusive cause of AIDS, and that once you have it, it is inevitable that you will develop AIDS and then die. That the only treatment is through major drug intervention, and that the HIV antibody test is what determines if you had AIDS. That the money should therefore go into more funding for more vaccines, more research, and that we should have compulsory laws that if you get your blood work done for anything, it should include an HIV antibody test, so that if it's shown that you have the antibody, even though you're totally well, you should immediately be put on some form of medical treatment. What if all that were wrong? Now, the average rank-and-file scientist, public health official, will say nonsense. But now there's over 2,000 leading scientists, including Nobel Prize winners, professors emeritus in molecular biology and virology and biochemistry, who are saying, we have had it wrong. These people come down onto two separate platforms. One is that HIV does exist, but is not capable as a very weak retrovirus of causing the 30 different conditions that we call AIDS. All of these conditions have always been around, but they've been called by a different name. In the absence of an antibody, they were called what they originally and always have been called, pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, or Kaposi sarcoma. Another group says that HIV itself has never actually been fully identified, and hence it is purely within the lifestyle, from bioxidative stress, from lifestyle that is destructive, that's caused these conditions and would have caused these conditions had we not had AIDS in any case. People were always dying at young ages based upon drug use and alcohol, combinations of the two. So we're going to look at both of those. But we're going to start by looking at how do we keep believing that our very existence as a society were threatened to the point where AIDS this year was made no longer just a disease, but a national security issue, and taken over, therefore, by the National Security Agency, the CIA, and other intelligence agencies, as if they were better prepared to fight this dreaded scourge. What if there is no scourge? What if we've had it all wrong? That's what this series intends to investigate. I will pick up where I left off last time, talking about how come we have accepted all the figures that more and more people are getting AIDS. Is it that more people are getting AIDS, or is it that we have simply reclassified old conditions as AIDS, and all because of what is considered an extremely faulty antibody test? For example, if you go into a hospital and you have a flu shot, there's a high probability that you will test positive for HIV. Why? Because HIV supposed antibodies cross-react with herpes, hepatitis, malaria, tuberculosis, leprosy, and common conditions like measles and arthritis and flu. So just in pregnancy, just having the things that people regularly have could test you positive, and then you would go on antiretroviral drugs, which are very powerful immune-suppressing chemotherapy, and in time, due to nothing more than the side effects of a medication, a powerful medication you should not be taking, you'd end up with what we call AIDS. So we're asking for everyone to stop for a moment and review the evidence. As could be expected, the, quote, implementation of the new definition artificially boosted the number of AIDS cases reported in the national AIDS statistics at least 250%. That is by 250% versus Collodion. That's according to a Dr. Collodion who reviewed the literature on this. In 1993, he says, medical status of about 36,000 completely healthy, asymptomatic HIV-positive Americans was changed on purely formal basis. They became, quote, AIDS patients only because of the new definition of AIDS, unquote. These positives had simply been moved from one pigeonhole to another, which had a drastic effect on the appearance of overall AIDS statistics. Michael Elner has a group that challenges the dogma on AIDS. His group offers weekly health support for people who have life-challenging illnesses. And he has HEAL, which is the name, the acronym for his group, all over the world now. And I visited these groups. I've guest lectured before them. And they're suffering from cancer and hepatitis and tuberculosis and all different conditions. But when they go on healthier lifestyles, the vast majority of these people improve their conditions or completely reverse them. And yet they were all told they had AIDS. Well, obviously they didn't have AIDS, and it certainly wasn't because of HIV. It was because of their lifestyle. The HEAL pamphlet brings out this. It says, quote, the new definition caused by the number of AIDS cases to double overnight. Prior to this change, AIDS cases had actually leveled off in all risk groups, unquote. While writing in what I consider the finest, most honest and accurate magazine on AIDS called Continuum, Molly Radcliffe gives us an example of the effect of another rewriting of the classification that occurred in the same year. Quote, in the beginning of 1993, the Center for Disease Control changed the definition of AIDS to include two conditions specific to women, unquote. These new additions to the list were the female-specific disorders, PID, pelvic inflammatory disease, which women have always had, and invasive cervical cancer, again, which tens of thousands of women have had. It has nothing in the world to do with AIDS. Nothing. But here's the game. Interestingly, in the year from 1993 to 94, just after the AIDS definition was changed, suddenly there was a 44% increase in the number of women diagnosed with AIDS in the United Kingdom. Well, how was it that we suddenly had a 44% increase? Because now any woman who came in with pelvic inflammatory disease that historically would have just been treated for that condition, or who had invasive cervical cancer and treated for that condition, now had to be listed as AIDS. Playing with definitions is how they continued to expand how people were classified. All they had to have was the positive antibody. Well, cancer frequently give you a positive antibody. Later on in our series, I will deconstruct the entire myth of the accuracy and legitimacy of this HIV antibody test. And when I do, I would imagine that many of you would suddenly for the first time realize that the entire war on AIDS and who has it and who does not, who's infected and who is not, is based upon a completely flawed and hence fraudulent concept and a myth. That there is an antibody test that can test for the accuracy of HIV. No such thing exists. Hard to believe? Wait till you see the proof. This is a sterling example of how a sudden boost of AIDS cases in a population segment, which will be reported as frightening evidence that AIDS is now attacking a new fraction of the population, is in fact due to a revision of a classifying scheme. The third of the three changes made in 1993 was to add pulmonary tuberculosis to the list of AIDS-associated diseases. Christine Johnson, a person who I have enormous respect for, who has done so much, meticulous work, real scholarship at the highest caliber, belittled this addition as one that is as apt to confuse as clarify who has AIDS. And I'll go into that in depth. The third change, quote, means that anybody, any human being on earth with tuberculosis can now be said to have AIDS. And you ought to know that tuberculosis all by itself causes virtually all the conditions that we now call AIDS. Depletion of the T cells, loss of weight, non-productive dry cough, localized infection, thrush, all those you can find in a person with tuberculosis. Well, now, how many people have tuberculosis? In Africa, it's endemic. In the United States, it's recurring. Now, who's most likely to have tuberculosis? People with grossly depleted immune systems. And who would those people be? Well, those are people who are generally drug addicts, whose entire immune system is in the toilet. Alcoholics, who also have a completely depleted immune system, and whose liver can no longer detoxify the body. People who have had recurring infections and who also at the same time are grossly malnourished. The number one cause for immune depletion in the world today is malnutrition. Malnutrition will cause your immune system to take a tumble from which it frequently will not recover. But now here's the interesting part. If you are malnourished and you have malaria and you have parasitic infection, you are far more likely to have tuberculosis. And that's why we see millions of people in Africa with tuberculosis who now are not called tuberculosis cases. They're called AIDS cases. Now, they haven't been diagnosed with a virus in the blood. No. You can find the bacterium that causes tuberculosis in their blood. Yes. You can find the parasite that causes malaria. Yes. You can find gross malnutrition in the blood, that they're deficient in virtually all the immune-supporting nutrients. Yes. You can find parasitic larvae in their intestine that can deplete their body of energy and cause a wasting disease. You can find it in their lungs, and you can find it in their liver, all of which means their body is on shutdown. Yes. You can also find that the stress hormones in these people from living in dire poverty, not having drinkable water, not having homes frequently, being immigrants due to civil war, you can find stress hormones in their body. Yes. All those things we can find. Yet we cannot find this virus. And yet we say these people who have tuberculosis, because of all of what I just mentioned, miraculously now they're said to have this virus-killing AIDS. How is it possible that reasonable scientists, public health officials, would not see through this charade? How is it possible that journalists would not go to Africa and see that in Village A, where they have clean water, lots of food, and are not stressed, they have no AIDS, zero. They also don't have tuberculosis. And in Village B, 100 miles away, where they have all the worst elements, they do have AIDS because they have tuberculosis. And why can't they see that when Village B is suddenly relocated to where they're fed properly, given medications for their tuberculosis and for their malaria, and they're given clean water, that their AIDS miraculously disappears, as does their tuberculosis? So how could they have had AIDS when we're told that you cannot reverse AIDS, when all they did is have lifestyle changes? How can one entire country in Africa have no AIDS because of its standard of living, and yet another country who is very poor and in civil war be called an epicenter of AIDS without seeing that it's the environment and the lifestyle? But that doesn't help those people trying to promote pharmaceutical drugs. That does not help the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. That does not help an administration that owes $80 million in political contribution favors given in the last presidential campaign to both candidates. to repay those favors. It doesn't help a $20 billion a year potential market just for antiretroviral drugs to these people. Doesn't help those. So follow the money trail. Journalists have refused to. Politicians can't. They're part of the scheme. Scientists are going to be beholding the people who pay them. So where is it left for someone to come forward and tell us, look at the facts, not opinion, not screaming, hyperbolizing, exaggerating, sermonizing advocates. Just look dispassionately at the facts. But we don't have that. That's unfortunate. Take a look at it a little different way. Just when it comes to the subject of TB, Christina Johnson said that overnight, someone who had tuberculosis now is told that they have AIDS. And you ought to know that tuberculosis all by itself causes depletion of T cells. And when you have tuberculosis, it can look exactly like you have AIDS, but you don't. You have TB. They're virtually indistinguishable. Now, as we go along, we can change the AIDS definition. I think three times now, by 1996 alone, they had changed it. And every time it includes more people who are less sick, unquote. Indeed, leading AIDS activist John Lauritsen has neatly laid out how the upward curve of AIDS patients has paralleled the lengthening definition. In 1984, he mentions, AIDS diagnosis depended upon a person having Kaposi sarcoma, or PCP, along with a weakened immune system. Quote, when the CDC expanded the list of AIDS indicator diseases in 1987, it caused an immediate boost of new AIDS cases by approximately one-third, unquote. If the CDC had stuck with the old criteria, quote, the incidence of new AIDS cases would have peaked in 1988. But with a neat little scheme and wanting to cast an ever wider net, the incidence continued to rise because they included more conditions that we've always had, as now AIDS indicated. As we saw, with the addition of three new defining conditions that had nothing to do with AIDS, but now were called AIDS, the count again was bolstered. And it's not only medical writers like Lauritsen that have been concerned with the unreliability of the advancing statistics, but also actuaries, whose job is to calculate risks of death and disease for insurance companies. A story in Continuum reports that the Society of Actuaries, quote, one of the most conservative and respected professional associations in the United States, unquote, with an international membership, set up a task force to, quote, examine concerns that Americans and others are being misled over the nature and extent of the AIDS epidemic. They say the increases are, quote, artificial, arising from drawing an ever-widening list of conditions into the AIDS net, unquote. According to Robert Maver, a member of the task force, his group was particularly vexed by the 1993 inclusion of T-cell count among defining characteristics of AIDS, and that, quote, people who test HIV positive and whose immune system cells fall below a certain number are now called AIDS cases, even though they may feel fine, and even though many different lifestyle factors can affect the T-cell numbers, unquote. His opinion echoes that of David Mertz, writing in Rethinking AIDS. Maver argues that when the newly added associated diseases, quote, are subtracted from the total, it turns out that the epidemic had leveled off in 1993. The opposite of what official statistics seem to show, unquote. While in Mertz's view, AIDS numbers from 1993, quote, will continue to decline at roughly the same rate year by year that they increased prior to 1994. The fact is that AIDS is not going to be fundamentally different from every other new disease in human history in following a bell curve of initial incidence and then later decline, unquote. Indeed, Mertz's predictions have been roughly correct in that AIDS cases have been steadily declining. I'll talk more about flawed predictions in the next program I do on this, but it's worth mentioning that according to the HIV/AIDS surveillance report, the decline has continued unabated. In the period from July 1996 to June 1997, there were 64,597 cases reported in the United States. In the following year, 97 to 98, there were 54,140 cases. And then in 1988 to 99, 47,083 cases were found, a large diminishment each year. It might be apropos to comment that these redefinitions don't always have it one way. There are times, though, that these are rare, when associated diseases are removed from the list of AIDS when they conflict with other parts of the definition. I noted in the introduction originally to this section that in 1985, being HIV positive was added to the defining characteristics of AIDS. However, this played havoc with the list of accompanying diseases since not all of them were attended by presence of the retrovirus. Dr. Duesberg addresses this. He says, this shows that the number and nature of AIDS diseases have been changed to save the HIV doctrine. When too many people died of Kaposi sarcoma, once considered the typical AIDS disease, without carrying the required antibodies of HIV, the CDC dropped it from the official AIDS list. Unquote. But I can remember when anyone who had Kaposi sarcoma immediately was told that they had advanced AIDS. And I remember one person in this radio audience coming up to me in 1985, 86. And I was doing a lecture. After the lecture, he came over and he said, "I'm really in a panic, Gary. I don't know what to do." I said, "Why?" He said, "I have Kaposi sarcoma." So he showed me his skin, and he had some raised purple blotchy skin. And he said, "They've got me on all forms of drugs, AZT." He said, "But I feel fine, except when I take the drugs." And he said that they now said I have full-blown AIDS. And he said, "I'm in a panic about it." After speaking with him for less than about an hour, I determined that, by his own admission, that he had been a very heavy recreational drug user, a fast-track gay who had been partying with unprotected sex with multiple partners each night. He had taken ecstasy and cocaine and antibiotics on a daily basis, frequently amyl nitrate as many as 20 per night. One is immunosuppressive. So I asked him, I said, "Have you ever gone to the scientific literature to read under Kaposi sarcoma, what a classical cause is?" He said, "No." I said, "If you had, you would see that one of the causes, by itself, with nothing else, is amyl nitrate, poppers. And that's just with a few. You're doing 20 per night? Why?" And he said, "Well, it's fun." He said he goes down to a particular bar in Manhattan, down on the West Side Highway, right at Christopher Street. And there he meets people who are into rough sex. And he was kind of a very muscular guy. And I guess he was about 5'11", probably around 190 pounds, very, very muscular. And they said it's a place famous for rough sex. I said, "What's rough sex? I'm not aware of that. What's it mean?" He said, "Go down there some night and watch. You can watch it all. And then there's a hotel on the corner where people go and party. And then there are the trucks across the street." So I told him I was going to go take a look at this. I didn't know about this. I knew, of course, of Christopher Street, but I didn't know about this other stuff, because I tried to let him know that just one of the things he was doing itself could have caused that condition, let alone the cocaine and the ecstasy and the angel dust and the heroin. He was doing everything. And yet, here's the interesting part, he would go and have his wheatgrass juice, and he would pride himself on being a vegetarian. And the only thing he didn't do was smoke, but he did all these drugs and all this sex and all this drinking. That's what I would expect, you know, with someone who is living in a very contradictory life. Like being years ago, I used to go out almost every month and do AM Los Angeles when Regis was on out there. And I finally stopped just because after a year it just became a hassle flying out there all the time. And I would stay with a friend who was a very well-known film producer up in Hollywood Hills. And my friend had that contradictory life also. When I would get there, we'd stop at a health food store and he would buy an entire car full of foods. I'd go through the store and I'd buy maybe 10 shopping carts worth of stuff because he had a big kitchen with like 7 refrigerators all in a row because he entertained a lot. And when we get to his house, the worst garbage in the world would be inside of his refrigerators. Stuff that not even a cockroach would think of eating. And that's what they ate. So we'd clear all that out, take an hour, just it all go out, sanitize it down, put all this good, healthy, organic stuff in the refrigerator. And while I was there for the 2 or 3 days, I'd cook and juice, and they were all into that, and all the people, celebrities who come by, who I won't name, but they were the considered the A-list of Hollywood, old-time and new celebrities. And even the old-timers would come by, and they would play backgammon, or they'd play cards with my friend. And they were all extraordinarily personable and charming and just delightful human beings. But every one of them smoked. They all drank. And there was nothing they were going to change. Even though most lived into their mid-80s, and they still could have still been alive today. But they just didn't see it. And they were always kind of amused when I'd serve a lunch and they'd have this healthy lunch and it would really, they'd enjoy it. And they always enjoyed the special fruity-kazooty fruit cocktails I'd make out of a pie and passion fruit and mangoes and watermelon and pineapples and crush it up with some, you know, ice and make that into a nice health drink for them. They'd drink it. But the day I wasn't there, they went right back to the bourbon and the scotch, and the smoking all day. And then the young Turks would come at night, and they were all into drugs. And I remember once that I walked over, and I said to a bunch of them, I said, this is stupid. You know, don't you know what danger sugar is? So I took this big bowl of sugar, and I took it and I put it in the toilet, and it freaked them out. And this guy just went ballistic on me. And he wanted to fight. I said, what's wrong? I said, look, you know, if you're that bent out of shape, go in the cupboard. He's got more sugar. He said, man, that one's sugar? That was cocaine. I said, okay. I said, well, I said, you know, that's your business, not mine. I'm not into drugs. And then later someone said it was like $20,000 I just flushed down the toilet. I thought it was sugar. But they were all into it. And you can't tell them because in the daytime, these same people you see at a yoga society, and there was a famous restaurant called, what was it, on Sunset Boulevard, Sunsprout or something like that, where everyone would go to have their vegetarian lunch. And I thought, what a contradiction. In the daytime, they're vegetarians doing yoga. At nighttime, they're into S&M and heroin. Is there something lacking in continuity of reasonableness here? And all those people today are sick. They're all strung out. And all the old ones are all dead. And it was unfortunate that nobody was willing to change. Not one. Now, I won't mention the celebrities' names, but I can tell you that some of the celebrities that we've all enjoyed and appreciated their gifts and talent, I would sit there and counsel them for hours, and they would yes you to death, and then 3 hours later, I'd go across the street to their house to take them over something I'd made, a big salad or something, and they'd be strung out on drugs. The public never saw this part of them. What a person does in their home is their right, their business, their privacy, not mine. But no matter what I said and did, not one single celebrity ever changed. Not one. Hence, I don't counsel them anymore because there's just no discipline. They're just gifted, but also petulant, obstreperous, contentious, selfish, and spoiled. And it's just unfortunate. So in that same context, here was a guy who's saying that he had been a listener to my radio show. Oh, by the way, I just want to tell you, if you've just tuned in, I'm Gary Nall, and we're talking about AIDS, and I'm just giving you a different point of view. Let's just allow our stations 5 seconds for them to identify themselves. We'll be back in 5 seconds. Please stay with us.
Well, it's a little more than 5 seconds, but in any case, this is WBAI, New York.
Giving this as an example of even when people say they want to change does not mean they will. Frequently, people will do some token thing towards health to appease their guilt, but then do something that undermines their health. So when they go to a nutritionist or physician and they're sick with cancer, heart disease, or what's defined as AIDS, do they ever tell that part of their background that is the contradictory part? In most cases, they do not. In fact, I interviewed over 2,500 gays on Castro Street in California, in Los Angeles, in the gay district, and the gay clubs, and in New York City. And now, of these 2,500 gays, these were not the vegetarian gays. These were known as fast track. And the only way you know that they're fast track is you go into the environment in which that fast track lifestyle occurs. 97%, 98% of all gays, their lifestyles, for all intents and purposes, outside their sexual preference, are fairly normal in the sense that they're as normal as any heterosexual. They may have different preferences in certain areas, but they're not doing something that would be any more harmful to themselves than a heterosexual would do. So you can't say then that being gay makes you susceptible to AIDS, because that wouldn't be correct. If you said that your lifestyle contributed to your disease, and then you track what in that lifestyle is immunosuppressive, you can frequently find all of the answers. And that's what I found both in the heterosexuals and in the gays. So anyhow, after talking with this person in the audience and asking him, would he be willing to really, really keep it focused on only doing things that honored his body? And he said he would. And he recovered completely within a year. No Kaposi sarcoma, no diagnosis of AIDS, HIV antibody negative. And he learned a powerful lesson. So 2 days later, I'm down at the at this particular bar. And I interviewed a lot of people because it was packed. I must have spent 6 hours there. And it didn't even get started till about 10 o'clock at night, and it went all night. Literally, when the sun came up, people were just getting out of the trucks across the street. And the trucks where people went by the hundreds a night, and still do, to have sex with just strangers. And you don't hear a word said. If you got on the truck, you'd see cigarettes lit all over the place, and people having sex, and unprotected sex, and then new people come on and the other people get off, and it's all night long. But in this particular bar, it was fisting and a lot of real rough sex. So I asked him, I said, you know, look, you're bleeding anally, rectally. You can see the blood coming down one guy's leg. And he said, yep. I said, well, that's got to be very painful. And I said, also, are you aware that that's ripping your anus sphincter muscle? Is ripping the inside, so any semen this guy's depositing in you anally, that's going into your bloodstream. And that semen is immunosuppressive, and if he's got hepatitis, you're going to get hepatitis. He's got syphilis, you're going to get syphilis. Herpes, you're going to get it. Gonorrhea, you're going to get it. And that's going to be immunosuppressive. And the guy says, oh, no problem. And this one guy had a pouch, and he opened the pouch, and the entire pouch was filled with tranquilizer, antibiotics, penicillin, at the highest potency. First, I wondered, you know, what physician was doing this for him, because that's patently illegal, and also is very unethical, because any physician should know that you cannot prevent a sexually transmitted disease by taking antibiotics prior to engaging with someone in a sexual unprotected act who is infected. So there was just this lack of awareness. And this one guy had had sex 16 times that night. And just a mess. And yet they were taking amyl nitrate. And it was the amyl nitrate that kept them from feeling the pain. It prolonged the orgasm and creates this euphoria for about 5 to 10 seconds. But it just destroys the immune system. Absolutely destroys it. And all you have to do is look in the scientific literature. So for the next 6 months, probably 3 nights a week, I would interview as many people in that community as possible, in the baths, in going from room to room to room. And it was just like, and they didn't do it because, A, they were, you know, angry at life and wanted to commit suicide. You talk with these people, they were doing it because it was fun. I mean, where else can you have all this drugs and all this sex and still feel good about yourself in the morning? And that was the mindset. And a lot of these people were very young. And they didn't believe that anything bad could happen to them. Well, when it did, nobody actually looked at the lifestyle. The worst that was said is, well, it was sexually transmitted. No one talked about all the other things that contribute to this constant antibiotic use and the drug use and the smoking and the drinking and malnutrition and the stress. No one talked about any of that. So I had a chance to see and interview people. And yet, time and time again, you'd hear these people talk about, yes, they were infected. And I interviewed a lot of guys who said that they had all kinds of illnesses, diseases, and yet they were still there because no one cared. And I remember speaking to this one guy, and I said to him, I said, you've got Kaposi sarcoma all over your legs. He said, yeah. He said, well, no one's having sex with my legs. I said, well, people see that you have this. Doesn't that scare them? He said, no. And I said, aren't you concerned that what you have, you could be infecting other people with? He said, well, you can't infect someone with Kaposi sarcoma. I said, yes, but it's not the Kaposi's you could infect someone with. It's the fact your immune system is depleted, and have you had a blood workup to see if you have hepatitis? Most of them who have had blood workups have had hepatitis. One guy had had active hepatitis 3 times in 1 year. And didn't stop him. Nothing seemed to stop these people. And yet when I then turned around and wanted to compare that with other gays, I was invited to speak at a group of the Gay Vegetarian Association. I didn't know there was such a thing, and there were about 500 people there. And I asked them and interviewed them separately afterwards, as many as I could. How many of you have had sexually transmitted diseases and any AIDS-defining symptoms and blood workups, etc.? And you didn't have any of the AIDS there. You didn't have the HIV antibodies. There were only, I think, 2 guys there out of the entire group who at least admitted, maybe there were more and didn't admit it, who had HIV positive, and that was because, yes, they were vegetarians, but they were also engaged in using the drugs and unprotected sex, multiple sex partners. So then that showed me that those people in the media and the religious right and the Republicans and others who were saying, well, it's a gay disease, they were wrong. It was not a gay disease, because what I did then, I turned around and I went over to the heterosexual community. And I interviewed so many heterosexuals who had none of the lifestyle factors that would contribute to it, with the exception of hemophilia, and who had no AIDS or AIDS-defining illnesses. Then I interviewed the fast-track heterosexuals. Now, these were people who, and maybe it was just that unique phenomenon that it happens, but most of them seemed to come through the garment industry. Because that's where the fast-track sex and drugs was really happening all the time, and had been from the 1970s on. And I went to a lot of the sex bars, the heterosexual sex bars and clubs, and I interviewed individuals and couples. And what I found was that those individuals and couples that did both the drugs and had the multiple unprotected sex, they also came down with disease. Disease that in a heterosexual would have been a heterosexual form of what we're calling AIDS. And so we had a model for both the heterosexual and the gay that were fast track that clearly showed that it was in the lifestyle, because the average heterosexual was not and has not been affected by AIDS directly, nor was the average gay. But we were led to believe that every single gay was out there was, you know, at risk, or, and it wasn't true. Then we try to make it a black disease. And I'll get into that on an upcoming program. But that's just to let you know that what was not happening is we were not really looking at who was coming down. We were making broad strokes, and the journalists weren't doing their homework. The people in the print media had more time to do their homework but didn't. The article writers certainly had the time and didn't. And in effect, we were apologizing by feeling their pain and feeling the pain of the families, and we were paying attention to their quilt making and the red ribbons and the causes and looking at Liz Taylor and Elton John and everyone raising money for more AIDS research. And more research and more and more research. And Elton John's just about ready to auction off 20,000 articles of clothes, which is probably about 0.5% of what he owns in clothes, for AIDS research. No one stops and says, well, hold on. We're spending $7 billion a year on research and treatment. What do we have to show for it? Is more going to make a difference? And no one went back to ask, let's go back to the beginning and let's reconstruct the scene and see if we can find a different understanding of this. It's as if we almost don't want to take a look back because it'll remind us in some way of evidence that was so clear and so obvious that we overlooked it. Too many reputations are at stake. Too much money has been spent. Too many egos have been let's say, stroked in the public arena. Nobody wants to admit they got it wrong. And so what did we do? We just kept adding on more conditions. Well, definitions are not the only way figures are artificially or mistakenly inflated. Dr. Philpott, a research scientist in the field of AIDS, who has made a particular study of the topic, points out how cumulative numbers can mask declines in cases. He points out, according to one agency, fewer new cases were reported in 1995, such as 73,380, than had been in 1994, 78,000, a 7% drop, while in 1994 itself was lower in cases than 1993. However, you wouldn't know that we were decreasing the number of AIDS cases each year from the glaring media screaming headlines like HIV/AIDS, growing. But it's not growing. The sleight of hand here involves cumulative figures. Quote, although the number of new cases has dropped each year since 1993, the cumulative number keeps growing, unquote. In other words, though it's true that the number of new cases in 1999 or year 2000 is less than previous years, alarmists report a 16% increase in the total number of cases. The number arrived at is by adding the year's total in, let's say, in Africa, or what they're projecting in Asia, projecting in India, projecting. These are projections. These have nothing to do with reality. And where are the projections coming from? Countries where there's civil war, where there's gross unemployment, where there's mass migration from sustainable farms to urbanization, poverty, like in Brazil. Well, why is it that you would have an epicenter of AIDS in Brazil, but not in Paraguay, or not in some other country in South America? Because you don't have the same type of poverty infrastructure. Well, with such artificial arithmetic, if only 5 new people were found to have AIDS, it would still be contended that the epidemic was burgeoning. Dr. Phil Paul goes on to point to another problematic manner of reporting AIDS figures, which is to stress how particular groups, quote, are grabbing a bigger share of the AIDS pie, unquote, without bothering to mention, quote, the AIDS pie is shrinking, he illustrates. For example, the 13,764 new cases among women in 1995 was 19% of the 73,380 annual total, compared with the 14,081 new cases among women in 1994, which was 18% of the 78,863 total for that year. So while 2% fewer women were diagnosed with AIDS in 1995 than 94, the fraction of women among total new cases was 1 percentage point higher. Purely a game of math, purely a game of manipulation. He has seen this bias mathematics used on the statistics for children and teens. In 1995, infant cases were down to 800 reported from 1,034 the preceding year, while the teenage numbers were 405, slightly down from 412 in 1994. However, by using percentages to show that these risk groups were increasing their weight in the overall batch, it is made to seem they are under attack by a virus in an extraordinary way. It follows, quote, most Americans are under the false impression that AIDS is overrunning maturity wards in high schools, unquote. Not true. The difference is 1 year you had 405, the next year you had 412. All right? That's seven people, seven in a whole country of 30 million teenagers. Seven. Not 700, not 7,000, not 700,000, not 7 million. Seven. But if you're dealing in pure mathematics, you can say, ah, there's an increase. But what if you said an increase of seven people? More people probably die each year of straining with constipation on a toilet and have a seizure than these seven. And yet, these are not people who died of it. These are just people who have it. Seven from 400. Statistically insignificant. But the headlines will blare that Americans, teenagers, are at risk. Another means of falsifying the numbers is by presumptive diagnosis. And as I've mentioned, in this type of procedure, a person who has one of the diseases that are commonly found in HIV-positive people are labeled as HIV cases without doing the necessary test to actually establish that the person is infected with HIV, which is presumed to accompany AIDS. As Nobel laureate Dr. Kerry Mullis stated in an interview with me, in the CDC's recording of AIDS cases, quote, frequently no HIV testing was done. None. Zero. A presumptive diagnosis is made, and it's included in the tabulations of an AIDS case. The CDC admits 40,000 such cases. But Duesberg argues, Dr. Peter Duesberg, that the number must be much higher. The just referred to Hill pamphlet that I mentioned a few moments ago highlights the absurdity of this policy by using an illustrative case. Quote, even though the only difference between pneumonia and AIDS is a positive HIV antibody test, the test is not necessary for the diagnosis of AIDS when these presumptive diagnoses are made. Lest I make this discussion too one-sided, it should be injected that those who feel presumptive diagnoses are justified can argue rightly that a number of the AIDS-associated diseases that are taken so to signify the existence of AIDS are not everyday ones. As Dr. Epstein observes, some of these diseases like PCP or toxoplasmosis are rare, while others such as herpes and candidiasis, which are more regularly found, are only considered as AIDS indicators if they occur in parts of the body where they are not usually located. However, this is by no means true of all AIDS-associated diseases, particularly newer ones added to the list, such as cervical cancer. Also highlighting the problematic nature a presumptive diagnosis is what was found when presumptive diagnoses are followed up, although such follow-up is rare. This happens when, after a presumptive diagnosis has already been conveyed to the epidemiological authorities, subsequent blood tests reversed the findings. As Dr. Michael Elliott stated in an interview with me, Dr. Peter Duesberg estimates these mistaken categorizations were based on, quote, examples in the medical literature where individuals were diagnosed with AIDS on the basis of disease conditions or immune deficiencies, and then the diagnosis was reversed when HIV was not found. Such cases make clear that relying on presumptive diagnosis is likely to prove another means of artificially boosting figures on AIDS patients. By the way, this is exactly what was done in Africa. In Africa, you go into a village, you don't have anyone to take the blood, you don't have any lab to test the blood at, so you take a look at the people, and you get all the people to come to a clinic, makeshift clinic, and like a World Health Organization person will be there and say, do you have a cough? Yes. What's your normal weight? 180 pounds. How much do you weigh now? 120. Do you have a fever? Yes. Okay, you've got AIDS. Next person comes up. Person has tuberculosis. Clearly they have tuberculosis. And they'll do the same thing. Or you've got AIDS. By the time they leave that village, virtually every condition, the illness that person could have has now been diagnosed as AIDS. What that does, it allows the World Health Organization, a highly political group, and very mercenary, completely self-serving, it allows them then to be able to say that there is an ever-growing epidemic of AIDS in Africa to which they are the only ones capable of helping to stop it. And the way you stop it is by you putting up posters for safe sex, hand out condoms, and make people feel guilty if they had the diagnosis. But nobody ever says, what about the virgins that you diagnose as having AIDS who've never had sex? Safe or unsex, no sex. And now in that village, when you've given them the diagnosis of AIDS, they'll be stigmatized. Nobody will socialize with them. Nobody will eat with them. Nobody wants anything to do with them. And sometimes, those people will be so depressed, they'll go out and commit suicide. Other times, they've been beaten to death, stoned to death. Sometimes, those people are suffering from such gross malnutrition and they're so weak, they can't get up off their bed. And where they would have had someone tend to them, at least when food was available, now nobody will even go near them because the stigma of AIDS in Africa is different than here. Now, does the person with the World Trade Organization says, you know something, this person simply, look at them. They're cachexic. They have had nothing to eat. We find they've had malaria and TB. And worms. They're drinking infected water. They have dysentery and diarrhea. They're jaundiced. Their liver's shutting down. Let's just get this person the proper medications. Let's get them some food. World Health Organization doesn't look at it that way. That's not their agenda. Their agenda is not to get people well. Their agenda is like almost all other AIDS organizations. Become self-serving. So they dutifully report what will never be questioned by journalists or authorities of any type. Well, they have a history of misleading, and they're also the ones responsible for giving contaminated doses of smallpox vaccines throughout Africa, which grossly adversely affected people's immune systems back in the 1970s. They have been at the controls of this entire world definition of AIDS, and it's done by presumptive diagnosis. They're wrong. They will not come forward and debate the issue with myself or other dissident scientists. But why should they? If they debated, they could be shown for being wrong. So they show up to the press conferences and give out their releases unchallenged. But they've got it all wrong in Africa. All of it wrong in Africa. And that's the danger of presumptive diagnosis. Again, let me stress that what is being teased out in today's program is that not that the CDC doesn't have every right to change its disease definitions as emerging situations warrant, but that such alterations are giving the public a highly misleading picture of how large the epidemic is, to the point that the declines are seen as increases and bigger slices are cut from a smaller pie. It's possible to say that these violent discrepancies between the dismaying statistics that appear in the press and the more hopeful ones that are found in, if the numbers are looked at with an enlightened knowledge of how they often crest due to redefinitions and other paper changes, can be totally blamed on the bad faith of the media who lust for frightening, hence audience-attracting numbers. But then, why didn't the CDC and other producing statistics for public consumption articulate in the press releases that in the U.S., there have been no dramatic increases after 1993, even with the reclassification of old and normal diseases as AIDS? It's possible to suppose that one small factor in play was a desire to cement the orthodox case. We saw the Kaposi sarcoma was dropped from the list when it contradicted the postulation that HIV caused the disease. On my next program, I'll examine, in a speculative vein, other reasons that may have led reporting agencies to go with misleading higher figures. And we'll discuss the implications of alteration on our next program. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to thank you all for listening to this ongoing series today, Part 7 of AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV. Have a good day.